Hello, everyone. It's 9 p.m. I see we have a very big crowd. Let me just quickly look at some of the names, old friends, new friends. For those who've never been with us before, it's really very easy. I mean, I'll speak about 45, 50 minutes, and then and as we're going, you can certainly type in questions or comments at the bottom. Usually, I don't get to them until there's a break in the action, or until usually I'll finish with 10 minutes to go, and then we'll be able to look at that as well. What else is there to say? Nothing else other than just again to welcome you all here. This is the I don't know what number we're at, 188, I think this is the 188th class. If you're interested, you can listen to the old classes by simply buying a Torah in Motion pass. I think for like $10 a month, you can download 30 classes and you can pick up where we are. We ended the last session was we dealt with the Aruch HaShulchan, and it's been a while. I think it was even spring, as I recall. I received emails from a number of you asking when the next set of classes will be. We have a very big crowd here live. That usually decreases as the semester goes, but we have many, many more listening on tape afterwards. It's not so simple. It took a while. For each one of these classes, it takes an enormous amount of preparation. But Baruch Hashem, we're now here to pick up another semester. I think he gave us seven classes. We'll see if we actually reach seven. I think we will. On Rav Natalia Tzihuner Berlin, the Nitziv, following on the classes on the Aruch HaShulchan, which is, I think, fitting, as we'll see, the family relation. I just want to say two updates before we get right to it. First, this will be of interest to at least some of you listening since last classes. I published this volume. I think you can see it here. Between last class and today, it's called Igros Malchei Rabbanon. It's 30 years of collected 30 years of letters of Torah greats to me. There's even something in there about the Nitziv. Maybe we'll get to. And if anyone's interested, it deals with halachic issues, historical issues. I've even been told it's quite unique and that it's very rare to find a sefer that has letters from them all the way on the right, Satmar, to all the way, I don't know if left is the good term, but religious Zionists and everything in between. So I just mentioned that. You can email me if you're interested about getting the book. You can get it online. It's also being sold now at the YU Sfarim sale. The last thing I want to do before we begin, just something I neglected to mention in our very last class dealing with the Aruch HaShulchan. As those who've been with us know, they're really, I just keep going. And wherever we end, we end. So, what we're doing today is a continuation, really, of the last class. And when people listen to it, they won't realize that there was such a big break between just to, and today, of course, let me get the date down. It's February 3rd, 2020. I saw in, it doesn't give the page number. It's like one of our Avraham Shapiro's books, and we'll end. This will actually be the official ending of the Aruch HaShulchan, and then we'll start with the Nitziv. He quotes our Meir Bar-Ilan in his book. I haven't found this yet, but it has to be in Mevilashon Yerushalayim, which a book we'll talk a good deal about. He says that there was a dispute between his grandfather, the Aruch HaShulchan, and Reb Chaim of Brisk. The Aruch HaShulchan, who we did, I think, seven classes about, I think we really went into him in a good way, held that the job of a rabbi, he says, is to sit in his place and decide halachic questions, whereas Reb Chaim Soloveitchik held that the job of a rabbi is everything in the community. I would just add to that, those who've been with us know that Reb Chaim actually held that it's not the job of a rabbi to answer halachic questions. At least he held it wasn't his job. And generally, the rabbi will answer halacha questions, but it's not something inherent per se in a rav. In a bigger city like Brisk or other places, you can have a dayan, And the rabbi doesn't need to answer questions. It's not really relevant per se. It's not necessarily part of the job description. If there's no one else to do it, the rabbi does it. But if there's someone else to do it, fine. And in Brisk, Rav Chaim did not answer halacha questions. You had Rav Simcha Zal Grieger to do that. So what is the job of the rabbi? And he quotes it there, and it's certainly correct, to take care of the community. Everything in the community. Take care of the widows. Take care of the orphans. Take care of if there's people being drafted. That's the job of the rabbi, according to Rav Chaim Brisker. I've mentioned before, it even goes further than that. Rav Chaim, not only did he not paskin shilas, he never spoke to the community, ever. He didn't give a Shabbos HaGadol drasha, a Shabbos Shuva drasha. Can you imagine today you hire a rabbi and he doesn't paskin for you and he doesn't speak to you, he doesn't give shiurim to the community, he doesn't do anything for the community in the normal sense of what people think of rabbis. Of course, with Reb Chaim, he did. He took care of the community in a larger sense, but day to day, how does he interact in a religious way? Why would the community want such a person? And as I mentioned already before, the community would want such a person because pride, having such a great Gadol b'Yisrael that he is your Rav. But as we said, the Reb Chaim, it's not that he didn't do anything, he just didn't do what people normally think the job of a rabbi is to do. A Magid can preach and a Posek can paskin, but the rabbi is the one who knows everyone in the community, who takes care of the community, who takes care of Reb Chaim. Reb Soloveitchik once said that his grandfather's definition of a rabbi is to take care of the unfortunates. That's the job of a rabbi. Okay, with that, let us move into our next unit, the Netziv. You see a picture of him right there. We'll get back to you, Baruch. I don't know. I mean, Rav Chaim. Okay, let me wait to the end. Rav Chaim's statement was stated for every rabbi. That's what he told his son, Rav Moshe, when Rav Moshe went to his first rabbinic position. That's what he kept. But I'll come back to Rav Chaim if we have time later. Rav Chaim was recognized as the Rav of the city. The fact that there are other shuls is neither here nor there. He was recognized as the Rav of Brisk. I don't know of anyone even in Brisk who thought of him otherwise than that. The Netziv, of course, you see his picture there. We have a few different pictures of him. See even with the payas. There's a picture, as I recall, even with the shrimal, but it has nothing to do with Hasidic. That's just the way many great rabbanim looked. He, of course, was a great figure. The fact that we've heard of him and we all know who he is shows us he's a great figure. He's great in the communal sense, we'll see, as the Rav of, as the Rosh Hashiva of Elazhin. He also served as the Rav of the city. That was a function that was given to the various rabbis of Elazhin. And he also was great as a scholar. In his various commentaries, almost unique, I would say, in terms of what he did and his approach. So great in two ways. Had he never been the Rosh Yeshiva of Elazhin, we still would be, and he never been a Rav, we still would be speaking about him, much like we do others, because of what he produced. Just making a note for myself. Every time I come up with these notes, I want to remind them so I can come back to you later. But of course, his life is tied to the Volozhin Yeshiva. So what we're going to do today and probably next class, we still need to deal a good deal with the Volozhin Yeshiva and his role in that. And what was this yeshiva, this special yeshiva? So let's begin first with the Netziv. And for those who are new, generally we spend the first couple of classes focusing on the biography and all the figures we deal with. It's not just their personal biography, but their lives encompass much greater trends. And that's certainly the case with the Netziv. And then we try to speak about some of his important works and their uniqueness, what they accomplished, etc. He was born in Mir. Today, if you look, I mean, it's been in Poland, it's in Belarusia, but it's in Jewish Lithuania writ large. And also, I think the whole world knows that wasn't there a Russian space shuttle, as I recall. His father was a merchant. Not a rabbi. His father's name was Yaakov, but we're told that his father was learned. And his mother also had yichus. His mother was from the Eisenstadt family. You know, the Eisenstadt descended from Reb Meir Eisenstadt, known as the Pani Meiros, Meir Ash, as he's known. Aleph Shin stands for Eisenstadt. Those who came with me to Central Europe this year, was it this year? No, the last year, one of the stops that we made was in Eisenstadt to go see the Kever, the grave of, I mean, it's on the way. And Eisenstadt itself is a fascinating city. It's one of the last Jewish functioning towns. That is, it existed as an independent town run by the Jews into the 20th century with its own Jewish mayor, its own, you know, everything that a town has. And it's quite fascinating. Rav Israel Hildesheimer opened up the first yeshiva, in Western yeshiva, with secular studies. And then, of course, from there, he goes to Berlin. And there's a lot to speak about. And while when we, and every year I take the group there, and last time, a year and a half ago, we go to see the grave of Meir Eisenstadt. Lo and behold, it's been completely redone with a new plaque and everything. And on it, a big thank you to President Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, for being at the forefront of redoing this kever in order to preserve America. This is what it says on the plaque. In fact, I see Ellie Dworetsky was with us, in order to preserve America's heritage abroad. Now, I have no idea what America's heritage has to do with the Panim Meirot. If you say he's a great rabbi in the 1700s, and there are people in America today who study his Torah, well, you could say that about many people, including many who are much more significant today than the Panim Meirot. So I'm not really sure of the details and how that happened. I do know that Rabbi Billet from Long Island was on that committee to preserve America's heritage abroad. But again, I'm not sure what the connection is per se. There's a lot of great rabbis whose graves could use being redone. In any event, that's the Panim Meirot, and that's who she was descended from. We know that, at least we're told, when I say we know, we're told. How do we know any of this stuff? Well, first of all, as we go further, there's an enormous amount of memoir literature, a lot of discussions. In terms of the family of the Netziv, there's two important things, two important sources. One is a biography from his son. So thank you, David Fishman, that the Mir space shuttle has nothing to do with this, the city. I never knew what the connection was, if there was. I never investigated it. This is the first volume, Rabban Shel Yisrael, Naftali Tzihuda Berlin. It's written by Mayor Bar Ilan, but in those days he was Mayor Berlin. You can see it here. Published in America, incidentally. You see it here, I think, by the Histadrut HaMizrahi BeAmerica. That's because during the war years, the Second World War, Mayor Berlin, later to be known as Bar Ilan, leader of the Mizrahi, youngest son of the Netziv, was in America, where for a time even, he was, they made him president of TI, I believe it was, Teachers College of Yeshiva College. And he was involved with the Agudas Rabbanim. And he wrote on the 50th anniversary of the passing of the Netziv, he wrote a biography. It's not that long, I guess 150 pages. And he describes on the title page, he's going to give you his toldos, his history, his hashkafa, etc., etc. And this, if you recognize, this is not an original printing. What I did was, you can see this book on HebrewBooks.org, and then you can go print it for yourself. So I had it printed. Then, in this volume, this is the reprint, Mivolozhin Ad Yerushalayim, which is an autobiography of Meir Bar Ilan, but needless to say, there's a great deal in there about his father, about all the big rabbis. It's a very important work, and that's another source. The fact that it's a son writing, obviously you have to take that into account. We'll see, I think, some examples. Well, maybe we'll have a different perspective, perhaps, than the son. There's also a good deal of information in Baruch Epstein's book, in Makor Baruch, one of the volumes in particular, and sections that were translated to English, you know, was My Uncle the Netziv. We spoke a lot about that last semester. I'll come back to that. Those who are with me know that I do not give Baruch Epstein much, I won't say much legitimacy, but much authority, I should say, in his recollections, and I'll especially return to that when I deal with what he has to say about the Nitziv's wife, Reina Batya, because I think that's a complete fabrication for reasons I'll explain. But in any event, there still is material of value in Reb Baruch Epstein as well. So we're told that the Nitziv's father, Yaakov, was successful. And we can believe that when we see what happened to his children. And his children did assume prominent positions in society. There's another book, which is also very relevant. Let me show you the title page right now. I appreciate this book very much. I enjoy it very much because you can see it here, Gil S. Pearl. He now is the principal of the Kohelet School in Philadelphia. He's a Harvard PhD. And the Pilgrim of Elohim of Talitz Yehuda Berlin in the World of 19th Century Lithuanian Torah Scholarship. The reason I like this book is because you see the lower right-hand corner, it says Studies in Orthodox Judaism. I have a series with Academic Studies Press. I published now about 10 volumes. And this was the first volume I published. It also was the most successful of the volumes. It's now you can get it inexpensively in soft cover and publish a number of volumes. But this, as I said, this was the first. The most recent one, I'll tell you, maybe some of you will find this of interest, although it's a bit of a secret, the most recent book that was published is this book, Yitz Greenberg and Modern Orthodoxy, The Road Not Taken. It happens 2019. Edited by Adam Furziger, Mary Ford Kendall, and Stephen Baim. It happens to be a fascinating book. I call everyone's attention to the introduction. Yitz Greenberg has what he calls a retrospective view of almost 50 pages. It's his autobiography. And it really is the story of the road not taken. Because if in the 1950s, if you had to predict which direction modern Orthodoxy would go, I think most people would have looked the direction of people like Greenberg. I mean, he becomes a well-known pulpit rabbi in Brooklyn and Riverdale. You would have looked to Rackman, to Goldstein, to Young. You would not have assumed that modern Orthodoxy would have gone the other road to the right, centrist, right-wing, whatever you want to call it. It's very different than modern Orthodoxy in the 50s and the 60s. And this has a number of essays, this volume, my own essay, deals with modern Orthodoxy and religious truth. I deal with Greenberg's attitude towards other religions and other people, Tamar Ross, Eugene Korn. The reason I say I'm letting you into a secret is because if you look in the volume, the other ones on the inside cover, it says, here's Studies in Orthodox Judaism, Mark B. Shapiro, and then it says who's on the editorial board. Alan Brill, Benjamin Brown, David Ellenson, Adam Furziger, et cetera, et cetera. Jeffrey Gurak, Mary Verkandel, Shlomo Katikashinsky. Editorial boards don't really do much. I mean, I might ask them to read it, and if I have an extra book, I'll send it to them, but it's sort of like an honorary thing. But if you see in this book, you won't have any mention of that. And that's because, and like I said, this is a bit of a secret because I don't want to write about it. They might be upset with me. Even though all the essays in this book, and they're good essays, James Kogel, Tamar Ross, Alan Jotkowitz, Stephen Katz, Alan Brill, Jack Wertheimer, Samuel Heilman, Sylvia Barak Fishman, etc., they all were peer-reviewed. Right before the volume is to go to press, they notice, Academic Studies Press, that I have an article in it as well. And they said, how can you have, it won't look good, it won't be maybe taken seriously, if it's in my series and I have an article. So they removed my name in the beginning with my permission, but it is my series and I'm very happy with this book. I think it has some great stuff. Okay, so let me read you what Gil Pearl says on pages 13 to 14 about the family here. Well, first he tells us, he gives us a bit of the history of the background of the family. He tells us about the brothers and the sisters, and their prominent position. On page 14, note 15, he says as follows, and this was complete news to me, never seen this written anywhere. The fate of Rivka Berlin, another of Yaakov and Batya Miro's children, is unclear. Bar Ilan writes that she married a man named Haslovich, but provides no further details. Contemporary members of the Bar-Ilan and Shachor families related to me that Rivka was baptized and married a general of the Russian army with whom she lived in the Belarusian town of Mitslavy, that's how you pronounce it, Amshislav in Yiddish. So here we have testimony from the family that the Nitziv sister converted to Christianity, Russian Orthodoxy, and married a general in the Russian army. Almost like it reminds you of A Fiddler on the Roof with one of the children there. We have plenty of examples in the days of the Nitziv of people leaving traditional Judaism, becoming maskilim, all sorts of things. But conversion, there were conversions, but from rabbinic families, it's unusual. I have a list of a number of them, but it is unusual. Let me point out something, though, that I wish I, you know, when you're the editor, your job is I read the book. And if it, I think it's good and make an impact, I recommend it. And this book is a very good book. I'm very happy I published it. You can also see here on YU Torah, a lecture by Gil Pearl, talking about the various travails he had in writing the book, because he focuses on the commentary of the Shiltos, which the Nitziv wrote, which we'll get to. And it's held by certain members of the family who are now, you call them, I guess, Haredi. And they didn't want to let him look at it. And when they did let him look at it, they were looking over his shoulders and they won't let him see certain areas. What Pearl wanted to show, and he was able to, is that there's citations of all sorts of things that you wouldn't expect, Mendelssohn and other things. And you can listen to the lecture for the details. So I read the book, but I never, you know, it's not my job as an editor to check every source cited. You know, if the author makes a mistake, they always say at the beginning, all mistakes are on his alone, are his alone. Well, in preparing for the class, these classes, I read a lot. I don't just come up and just start speaking. And one of the things I read was Bar-Ilan's book. And I just mentioned to you that he quotes here that this Rivka married a man named Chasovich. Well, let me read to you what it actually says on page 15. I don't know how to explain this error by Pearl. Sometimes you make a note for yourself, and then when you write it, you don't check. I'm not really sure, but what it says is it mentions Rivka Berlin, and let's see, let me find the source here. Actually, it's not. It's not on page 15. First of all, it's on page 16. It says that the second of the daughters was Rivka, Asher Gara Be'ir Chaslovich. It doesn't say she married a man named Chaslovich. It says she lived in Chaslovich. Chaslovich, many of you know Chaslovich. Chaslovich is famous because that's the second city that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was Rav in, and that's the city that Joseph Baer Soloveitchik grew up in, Chaslovich. It was a Chabad city, or at least so they claim it's a Chabad city. Munshein has a piece where he rejects this, that it's not true, that it's, yes, there were Chabad there, but it's not really a Chabad city. In any event, that's so we can remove this notion that she was married to someone named Chaslovich, but the idea that she converted, she apostatized, that's attested to by the family. What's also of interest is that the Nitziv's father, and I assume his mother also, although I'm still in the middle of reading a number of stuff on the Nitziv, so I haven't got an answer to this. I don't know if this is the case, but I don't even know if the mother was alive then. It just says the father left, and sometimes fathers would leave the mother's home, but the father left Lithuania when he was around 50 years old and went to Eretz Yisrael. I have to look in, maybe in Mivolaj and Ad Yerushalayim, he gives the details. I actually just got the book, you know, from Israel. This is a new printing. I didn't want to read it online. It's hard to read online. I didn't want to print it out. And so I got a new edition. Maybe he mentioned something. In any event, the father, Yaakov Berlin, leaves Lithuania and goes to Eretz Yisrael. That shows already a connection to the land, which we'll see the Netziv also picks up on. Furthermore, two of Yaakov's sons, that is, two of the Netziv's brothers, also do this. That is, they leave Lithuania and go to Eretz Yisrael, something which was not very common. You need to really be committed. It wasn't the easiest place to live in those days. This shows that this the love for Eretz Yisrael, Chovev Tzion, the idea of being a Chovev Tzion, is not something that just came to the Netziv. It's really part of his family tradition, which he absorbs from his father, his whole family. He himself, the Netziv, marries at a very young age, 14 and a half is the figure we're given, and his bride is even younger, Reina Basia, age 13. She's the daughter of Rav Yitzhak of Volozhin, the son of Rav Chaim of Volozhin. Now, Reina Basia is famous in her own right, and I dealt with her last semester a bit, and I'll come back to her later on, simply because I have my own view about this. The portrayal, her fame, is a direct result of one of the chapters in Reb Baruch Epstein's Makor Baruch, and for reasons I have explained in print, and I'll explain for the listeners, I think it's a fabrication. I don't believe it is true at all. This doesn't mean that I'm an anti-feminist or anti anything like that. It has nothing to do with that. I just think historically it can be shown that it's a fabrication, as with much else that Reb Baruch Epstein fabricated. It's a very strange situation of someone who's a great Torah scholar, whose work the Torah Tamima is a wonderful work. On the other hand, as we spoke last semester, this comes together with creations, I guess you could say, of all sorts, which are not cannot be believed. After the marriage, the Netziv moved to Volozhin. Although, as with so many of these things, we have different versions. Another version, not the family version, has him being married while already in, having been in Volozhin. And according to this version, he had come to Volozhin when he was age 11. So it's hard to get to the bottom of these things. We'll never know the exact answers. But what we can say is that from his youth already, he's in Volozhin and he's married. Now, Rav Chaim Berlin and the daughter who would marry Rav Raphael Shapiro, a figure we'll talk about, I think, later on, were from the Netziv's first marriage. The Netziv will have a second marriage. Rav Chaim Berlin is, he is 48 years, if I remember correctly, 48 years older than his brother, Rav Meir Berlin. And the Netziv was 15. He was not even 16. I checked it just yesterday on Wikipedia so you can see the dates of when the Netziv is born and Rav Chaim Berlin is born. He's not yet 16. So he's 15 years old when the Netziv, well, he's 15 years old when Rav Chaim Berlin is born. So it's an incredible thing that, then it's Rav Meir Berlin writes about his brother. It's not like he grew up in the same house as his brother. 48-year difference. You can check it, but I believe that's what it is. Meir Berlin is from the second marriage. And the wife, the second wife, lived on for a number of years. She even came to America, and then she went to Eretz Yisrael. I have a picture of her. I found a picture of her. I'm going to put it on the Sforim blog. It's together with a picture of Rav Kook's wife. I have never seen online a picture of Rav Kook's wife, and I've never seen a picture of, and I had no idea what she looked like, and I've never seen a picture of the Netziv's wife. Well, there are pictures of Rav Kook's wife. As far as I know, they're not online, but I asked people, and there definitely are pictures. And there are pictures of the Netziv's wife. I asked Meir Bar-Ilan, Professor Meir Bar-Ilan, who is obviously a direct descendant of, and a great scholar in his own right. They had pictures, but I have a picture of Rav Kook's wife together with the Netziv's second wife, Meir Bar-Ilan's mother, which I discovered in Jerusalem. And when I get to it, I will get to it. So stay tuned, I'll post that. The Netziv is portrayed in a number of sources as having been of average intelligence. There's really two trends in hagiography. One is the one we're used to, is that the youngster is a genius from early on. He knows Shas at age 10, 11. Everyone is amazed at his great brilliance. But there's also another trend, which you see, it's less common, but you see it, and you also see it with Nitziv, is that the youngster was only of average intelligence. And how did he become so great? Because he put his mind to it. He sat and learned day and night. And I think that type of hagiography is created precisely in order to motivate people, because after hearing about how all these great sages from their youths, they were geniuses, how is the yeshiva bachur supposed to be inspired? He's never going to reach that. So therefore you create a story about another great sage who, you know what, Yanko, he's just like you. He didn't have such a great head, and he made it because he put in all the effort. And that version is just as hagiographic as the other one. In this case, I have no doubt that it's false. I can't imagine that it's true, both because of what the Nitziv became, and also it's hard to see that Rav Yitzchak of Volozhin, this is the sort of son-in-law he would have wanted. But okay, maybe it is true. I don't know. Pearl discusses this, of course, in the book, and he actually quotes Baruch Epstein. If it was only Baruch Epstein saying it, I wouldn't put much stock in it. But it's not only Baruch Epstein who says it. But he quotes Baruch Epstein that the Nitziv was of average intelligence, and it was only through his diligence. And what Pearl says is the available evidence suggests otherwise. I'll just note that, and this is not mentioned by Pearl, that this was part of the legends of the Nitziv. And there's an independent source for this as well. This is a very interesting book called Yeshivot Rita, Pirkei Zichronot, edited by Emmanuel Etkes and Shlomo Tikashinsky. It contains memoirs, different sections. The first section is all about Volozhin, and then you have about Tells and other yeshivas, including the Lida Yeshiva and Sopot, the Musa Yeshiva, Sopotka, Lomjan, the Vardik. And I found that in this book, on page 115, there is an essay by Moshe Eliezer Eisenstadt, and he says as well that on page 115 that he wasn't, he wasn't a great learner. So maybe it is true. His nephew, namely Reb Baruch Epstein, reports that precisely because he was not such a great learner, his relationship with his father-in-law, his wife was not the greatest, and he was not well liked in the yeshiva because he was one of the heirs apparent. There are more than one son-in-law, but he's one of the people who's going to take over the yeshiva. We all know that yeshivas are family businesses, and the fact that they didn't think much of him could have created problems, as you can imagine. Already by 18, and I'll get to the questions, I'll get to all the comments in about, let's see, 9:30, in about 20 minutes. Already by 1841, when the Nitziv was 25 years old, he's giving the daily shiur at the yeshiva instead of his father-in-law. So even if he didn't start out with the greatest head, he obviously had progressed enough that he could give the shiur. Itzela dies in 1849, and his eldest son-in-law, his name is Rav Eliezer Fried, he becomes Rosh Yeshiva, and the Nitziv is his assistant. Problem is, Rav Fried dies in 1853, and it would appear that, who's the family member to take over? It should be the Nitziv, the other son-in-law. However, there was another rabbi who was in town, and that's always a problem when he's in the city. And he was married to a granddaughter of Rav Itzela Volozhin, so that gives him rights of a sort to the yeshiva. And his name is Yehoshua Heschel Levin. Very, very interesting figure, as we'll see in a minute. Well, first of all, he's the author of the book Aliyos Eliyahu, which is the classic. I don't even want to call it a hagiography. It's really different than that, but it is a hagiography to a certain extent of the Vilna Gaon. But he, well, first let me set the stage. He's living in Volozhin. He's giving shiurim in his home, which were attended by certain students. This is obviously creating a problem because it's creating another center of leadership. So the yeshiva makes a decree that no students are allowed to go to any private homes for shiurim, obviously intending that. But he's not just a Talmud Chacham. He's a fascinating figure because he's a bit of a maskil as well. You can find details in a number of places. Most easy, this book. This is a wonderful, wonderful book published by my favorite press, Littman Library, Shaul Stampfer. Shaul Stampfer wrote his doctoral dissertation, which was then on the Lithuanian yeshivas. This then was published in 1995, as I recall. And then there was a second edition published. And this is the translation of the second edition with more information, in fact. So this, you're getting the most up-to-date. You needed a second edition in particular. First, it sold out, but more importantly, because the archives, after the Soviet Union fell, we now can really get to the story, and Stanford does, as to what happened, why the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed down. The story, which everyone always repeated, was because the Russian government insisted on secular studies. It was always a very strange thing because there was other yeshivas as well. Why is it that the Volozhin Yeshiva, what about Mir? What about Sobotka? Why only the Volozhin Yeshiva were they so insistent on secular studies? And if you look at the type of secular studies they were insisting on, by definition, it would have meant the end of the yeshiva. I mean, it's not like they wanted a little bit of secular studies. The whole yeshiva was going to be turned into secular studies with only a little time for Torah studies. So clearly that was a move to shut the yeshiva down. Why would the yeshivas were legal in Russia? Why would the government want to shut it down? So we'll speak about this in a few classes because now Stanford has revealed what's in the archives, and now we can really understand what was going on there. Part of the yeshiva legend was that the Netziv closed it down because he opposed secular studies. And one of the people responsible for, and opposed secular studies in the yeshiva, and he never would have agreed to something like that. And it was actually Rav Chaim Berlin, who was one of the people to spread this legend. The fact is, however, I think Rav Chaim Berlin was saying this for reasons of, because in contemporary Orthodoxy, it was important for him to stop the movement of wanting to put secular studies into the yeshiva, because the fact is that there were secular studies in the Volozhin Yeshiva. There were secular studies with the approval of the Netziv in the Volozhin Yeshiva, and everyone became aware of this with J.J. Schachter's famous article, I think it's in the second Torah Mada journal, on this very issue of yeshiva, the Volozhin, and secular studies, which was precipitated by an event when the Lakewood Cheder sent out an English translation of part of the Baruch Epstein, my uncle, the Netziv, in which it spoke about the secular studies. That seems to be the reason why they recalled the volume. So it's a wonderful article as well by J.J. Schachter. So what does Stanford say about him on page 68 and 69? You can get elsewhere as well. He mentions sources that he was well-versed in literature, was friendly with maskilim, such as Mordechai Gunzberg and Rashi Finn, Shmuel Yosef Fun. At the same time, by the way, he supported an organization devoted to the monthly public recitation of texts about the ancient sacrifices. So we're dealing with someone who was pious, who was a serious Torah personality, as well as, we've mentioned many times before, in Lithuania, you have a number of people who are called maskilim, but the term maskil in Lithuania for these people has nothing in common with the way the term would have been used as Galicia or Germany, let's say in Germany 100 years earlier than that. He goes on, Stanford talks about how he was the first attempt in Eastern Europe to publish a rabbinical journal, which one issue came out, et cetera, et cetera. He published a letter in the journal, a study of the name Todros, where the name Todros comes from, in the journal Zion, Sion, which was published by the historian Marcos Yost, and he was far from Orthodox, Marcos Yost. He wore modern dress, according to Citron, etc. So we're not dealing with a typical Lithuanian personality. And as I mentioned, he's the author of the work Leos Eliyahu about the goat. Now, Levin and his family believe that he should be the Rosh Yeshiva. And towards the end of Rav Eliezer Fried's life, he actually made this claim. And most people don't realize this, but the dispute with the Netziv is actually a continuation of the earlier dispute with Rabbi Fried. Now, there were obviously personal and family interests involved here, but there also were ideological differences. Stamfer on page 71 quotes Levin's nephew, and he mentions how, I mean, had he taken over, it would have been a completely different yeshiva. He left a manifesto that was found after his death. And the nephew says that he said that his uncle said the Volozhin Yeshiva should be organized to produce rabbis for the Jewish community of Greater Russia. He wanted that there be classes, and a prominent rabbi should come and hold examinations, that you should move people up by different classes, and then they would receive smicha. They would also have to learn the Russian language, history, geography, and arithmetic. So he's more, I guess, open-minded to the outer world and to changes in the yeshiva than Netziv ever would have been. He never becomes Rosh Yeshiva, so I don't see how that would have been developed. In order to settle this dispute between Levin and the Netziv, outside rabbis were called in. And the decision was that the ruling was that the Netziv would be the Rosh Yeshiva. And Rav Levin was not given anything. Who was appointed the deputy Rosh Yeshiva? You might have thought that in a situation like that, they would do a pashara, a compromise, and appoint him as a deputy. But no, he was out. I guess they saw that there's a rabbinic expression, you can't have one crown and two kings. So the Netziv is going to be the king, and Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi, who also has a family connection as a descendant, as I believe he's the great grandson of Rav Chaim of Volozhin. He also has a connection. He's appointed the deputy, the Sgan, Rosh Yeshiva. Now, an interesting part of the ruling, you can see a text of the ruling that was given by the rabbis, is that nevertheless, a monthly payment was to be given to the rabbi's house, namely descendants of Rav Chaim of Volozhin. And Rav Levin is given 4 rubles a month, which is half what the Netziv got, and 1 ruble less, only 1 ruble less than what the Beis HaLevi got. And I have to say, this is quite generous because the Beis HaLevi is working for his money for the yeshiva and getting paid. And here Levin is getting almost what the Beis HaLevi is getting, and he's not working for it. Stamfer on page 73 and 74 just continues the story how he leaves Volozhin Levin, he returns to Vilna. He was one of the first supporters of the artist Mordechai Main, who I have to confess, I don't know who Mordechai Main was, but he's an artist. He's one of the first to propose, it says, the creation of a national library in Jerusalem, and he published polemical works against the Haskalah. Someone who was influenced by the Haskalah is publishing polemical works, and he ends his days as rabbi of the East European Jews of Paris. And he finally, Stamfer mentions that this is just speculation, but he thinks that perhaps one of the people who stood behind Levin's attempt to take over the yeshiva was none other than Rav Yisrael Salanter. And you can see here that they had a relationship, a friendly relationship. Rav Yisrael Salanter also was in Paris for a time. Go for 5 more minutes. A few years after this, in 1856, the great rabbis were once again called back to Volozhin to deal with a new dispute, this time between the Netziv and the Beis HaLevi. We don't have contemporaneous evidence discussing, the dispute per se. What we do have is the ruling of the rabbis, and that allows us to see exactly what the dispute was all about. For example, it states that no students can degrade the honor of either rabbi, which obviously tells us that this was being done. And we do have memoir literature that discusses it. I'll give you some other examples of the ruling, but I want to call your attention to another book. And she mentioned something which I believe is completely incorrect. Here's a book by a fascinating woman. Her name here is Hannah Katz. She has, and it's called Mishnat HaMetziv, and it's a study of Shitato HaRayonit VeHachinuchit ShaHaMetziv MiVolozhin, or Kitavav VeDarchei Hanagato. She's looking at his ideas and his educational approach based on his writings. She's also known as Kahat, Hannah Kahat, and she published a couple of years ago a massive volume, maybe 650 pages or so, on attitudes towards Torah study. She is the daughter of Rav Shlomo Fisher. I don't know if he's officially Rosh Yeshiva. I think at the end he was Rosh Yeshiva. He was a figure in it for a long time, of the Itri Yeshiva, and one of the greatest Torah scholars in the land of Israel. I mean, a man who knows an enormous amount among all sorts of things. Quite a unique personality. He has not published that much, but what he has published has been his Beis Yishai, especially his drashot. You see already we're dealing with a fascinating personality, and I've never had the privilege of speaking to him, but I know many people who've spoken to him, and just he's quite unique. Even though most of the yeshiva students only know him as a Torah scholar, he's incredibly broad. Perhaps shouldn't be surprising that his daughter is none other than Hannah Kahat, Hannah Katz, and she thanks her father in this introduction to the book for reading over the book, his comments. She says as follows, on both page 9 and 59 to 60, that the dispute between the Netziv and the Beis HaLevi, let me just read it to you, it's better, was about their method of learning. That was the dispute. She says on page 50, and that led to everything. She says on page 59 that the dispute, be'ikara, was machloket methodologi, the methodological discussion, that they disputed over the method of proper approach to learning. The Beis HaLevi was harif, he was brilliant, chidushim, and with pilpul, whereas the Netziv was more like the Vilna Golem's approach, focused on pshat, on the daf, etc. And her source for this is Karlinsky. Karlinsky has a famous book, the first one of the Brisker dynasty, all about the Beis HaLevi. Yet if you look in Karlinsky, that's not what it says at all. What you see there, and this is what you see in all the other sources, is that the dispute started for other reasons, personal reasons, that it's hard, the two people to get along, they have different ways of running the yeshiva. Once the dispute already started, then the students got involved, and then the students started mocking the Netziv, that is the followers, the Beis HaLevi, started attacking the Netziv, he's not enough of a big lamdan, and then the Beis Medrash breaks into two camps, in which the followers of the Netziv's approach of learning on one side, the followers of the Beis HaLevi on another side, and terrible things were said and done. But that's not why the dispute started. It wasn't an ideological dispute about approaches to learning, and that's what led to the dispute. Not at all. Once the dispute started, however, each side lined up with the method of learning that they followed. And we think of the great students in Volozhin, I mean, you can see what type of approach they would have followed. In general, we can say that the Netziv does not have much in the way. There were many, many great Torah scholars who went to Volozhin. I'm thinking of the entirety of the Volozhin yeshiva. And when you look at the great Torah scholars, almost to a man, they look towards either the Beis HaLevi or Reb Chaim. The one exception that stands out, there must have been more, but he's the one exception. And he himself was unique, so you can see why he would have been brought to the Netziv was Rav Kook. But if you go down the list of the great Rosh Yeshiva and Talmidei Chachamim who come out of there, they were not regarded as Talmud Mufak of the Netziv, precisely I think because the Netziv is so broad and his approach is so much different than the typical yeshiva approach that it's not fitting for everyone. Let me just read you what The other what are the some of the other rulings of the rabbis were, so we can get a sense of what part of the problems were. You see this as well in Stanford 76 to 77. First of all, as I said, that the ruling of the rabbis was, first of all, the students are not allowed to degrade the honor of either rabbi. When you read about what was happening and what the students were doing, and we can carry this through in all the yeshivas. I mean, later on, maybe we'll get to what happens when the Netziv tries to appoint his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, Rosh Yeshiva, what the students did. It's, you have to understand also, you're dealing with students, 15, 16, 17, 18, with no outlets, they're kids. And they sometimes acted like kids. It's hard today, I used to say, to imagine that such a thing could happen. I would say that years ago, I remember saying when I first learned about what happened in Tells and what happened in Slobodka and what happened in Vajna, and my attitude was, I can't imagine this ever happening today, impossible. And then I was proven wrong. Anyone who's followed what's going on in the Panevez Yeshiva, you see the exact same thing. You see people throwing chalent, sorry, start throwing kugel at each other. You see people throwing chairs at each other. There was a stabbing there. You see different sides of the Beis Medrash. You see almost a riot that broke out last year. You can see the video on YouTube. So it's not only in the past. Unfortunately, young people with no outlets, even if they're Torah students, will be led to do these things. What else? What other paragraphs were? Regulations for the admissions of students. Obviously, this shows you that the Beis HaLevi and the Netziv had arguments over this. We know that there were cases where the Netziv rejected someone that the Beis HaLevi wanted. So what was the rule? The Netziv is authorized to decide if the student is accepted or not, unless the candidate comes with a letter addressed to the Beis HaLevi. That is, there's a community rav who knows the Beis HaLevi, and he sends a letter to the Beis HaLevi. Then the Beis HaLevi can bring the student in, and it's his student. He can, it reminds me when I applied to graduate school, one of the places I applied was Columbia. I was quite stricken with Professor Halivni. He came once to, I was in Brandeis for, I was a student at Brandeis, and Halivni came for Shabbos. Just his son had been a student there. That's not why he came. He came, they brought him up. He gave a talk there, and he spent Shabbos. And the whole Shabbos I spent with him, and just his person. If you've ever, I know he's not well now, but if you've ever spoken to him, you know that just on a personal level, he was so warm. And I wanted very much, even though what I wanted to do was far from his interests, I wanted to study with him. So of course I applied and everything. And I remember I called him and I said, so what's doing? You know, I haven't heard from Columbia. And he said that, no, it's not a problem. He says, each one of us can grab our own students. So, because he knew me and he wanted me, that I didn't have to go through, it's not like just coming out of the blue where the members of the partner would sit together and decide who to take and who not. Well, the problem was that, as he explained to me, that he could take me as a student, but he still had to fight with all the other professors over the money. And a graduate students, what are we gonna be? We're not like going to law school or medical school where you take out money. If you and then you have to pay it back. You're not going to make enough money later to pay it back. You'd be in debt for 30 years. So graduate school is free, but not only is it free, they give you generally it's free, but they also give you stipends and all that. Imen kemach ein Torah. At Columbia for me didn't come through with the money I needed, and Harvard, which has endless money, they came through. So sometimes I wonder how life would be had I ended up, had Columbia been able to come through with the money and I ended up there. Let me just continue and then I'll end with this. What are the other the rulings of the Beis Din? Both rabbis had a right to discipline students. And we have a source mentioned that he mentions, he quotes a source here that the dispute between the two rabbis actually began over the rejection of a student that came with a recommendation of Rabbi Meisel of Ludge. And then it goes on and he talks about how the Beis HaLevi benefited most from this ruling. In fact, the Netziv was not allowed to spend money without the Beis HaLevi's approval. Originally, admissions were just the Netziv. Now the Beis HaLevi could admit some people. emissaries of the yeshiva who would go out and raise money could not be dismissed unless both of them agreed, et cetera, et cetera. And they also, they resolved the financial status. So we will end here with the machokas of the Beis Halevi and the Netziv. We're just getting started. We will pick up right where we left off. Starting to get really interesting now. And we'll pick up next week, this time with another dispute and Volozhin. What is Volozhin? But let me first get back to these the questions here in the comments. Okay, Baruch says Roberto Wine is quipped that he doesn't know why they named a spaceship after the yeshiva, or was the quip the reverse? And we got the answer already from David Fishman, who I feel a bit, some of the things I'm going to say, either please write down or email me, because he's a great expert in a lot of these matters we're going to be discussing, David. So it's a big honor to have you here. Yossi asks about Gil Pearl's dissertation. Yes, which I spoke about. There I go. And I highly recommend, again, if you have a chance, YU Torah, a wonderful lecture he gives on the vicissitudes of writing his dissertation. Because I had the same experience when I had to get the letters from Yochai Yaakov Weinberg. They're held by people often, just like the manuscript of the commentary on the Shiltos. They're held by people who don't agree with the entire concept of academic Jewish studies. So why are they willing to allow you to look at it? And if they are willing to allow you, they want to control, and he speaks about this, they want to control the outcome. I have to say that my experience, I mentioned this before, was quite positive. All the people, with only one exception, everyone, and this includes people who's Mordechai Gifter. Is there anyone with a reputation more at odds with you know, academic Jewish studies, the academic world? He's a Yeshiva College graduate, and he turned completely against it and had only negative things to say. Yet, he couldn't have been more gracious in giving me the letters. The Soloveitchik family, if you know the Soloveitchik family in Israel, they're not Aguda. They're almost like Naturi Karta. They're like anti-Aguda, all the way to the right. They were very generous in giving me the letters, and I can go down the list of people in the so-called Haredi world, the anti-academic world, and with one exception, they were very happy to give me the material after speaking to me and after concluding that the fact that I don't look like a yeshiva guy, I did not do any phony stuff. I didn't put on a black suit and a black hat. I went the way I am. I explained to them what I'm doing. And when they were convinced, I guess, I don't know, convinced in my Erechkeit, whatever word you want to use, they gave me the letters, and I'm very, very grateful, because I could not have written what I did without these letters. So I feel it's important to make this point, because people often, you know, caricature people on the right wing as being completely opposed to academic studies. It's not true. We have people right here listening to us from the right wing world. People who read the Sfarim blog post, my other books. You know, it's a caricature. It's a wrong caricature that people in the Haredi world are not appreciative and interested in academic stuff. One of the Dayanim of the London Basin. Matters in the end didn't turn out too well for him, if you know the history of the Dayan I'm referring to. But he was not Dayan Abraham, so Rav Kasriel David Kaplan. But he also gave me material, unpublished material. The only thing he said to me is not to publish it, but I could use it because you know, he has the manuscripts, the original manuscripts, and he wants to sell it, and it would go down in value. But here, these are Haredi, not just Rabbanim, you know, big figures, poskim, you know, giving me this stuff. Oh, thank you, Harold Pearl. Okay, yeah. Obviously, family, what was the Rosh Yeshiva reading? Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful lecture. Okay, Baruch asks, what about Russian church records? They record such a thing. I don't know. You'd have to go look. I don't read Russian, so I wouldn't know. David says, does the last name Berlin connote that the family originated from the German city or children of Beryl? in as much as the name Rachlin means children of Rachel. I mean, we assume often that Berlin, Berliner means there's some connection, but there's so many examples of people who have no connection. And I'm not sure how they got the name. There's no record of any connection going back to Berlin. And remember, the Jews were not living in Berlin for that long. So I'm not sure. Baruch is happy I'm pronouncing the name Basia, not Batya. Obviously, historically correct. And Baruch, let me mention that because in the academic world, we're taught that you have to use the Sephardic pronunciation in writing. I, without even realizing it till my book was published, I wrote something which makes no sense to anyone reading it precisely because I used the Sephardic pronunciation. I was writing about the new cheders that were established in the end of the 19th century in Russia. You know, they're called the cheders metukanim. So fine, so I'm writing about metukanim. But then I said that, the religious Jews would mock them, and instead of calling them metukanim, they called them mesukanim, that is dangerous cheders, dangerous because they teach secular studies, etc. What I didn't point out, and I didn't even realize when writing it that people won't know what I'm talking about, won't get the pun here, is that for an Ashkenazic Jew, a Russian Jew, he would refer to, corrected cheders, improved chadarim. He's not calling them a tukanim, he's calling them a sukanim also. So they're pronounced the same way, it's just the way they're written, with a suf or with a sin, or with a samach. So I myself was so indoctrinated in how to write, Sephardic writing that I did not mention that. So yes, the name is Basia. So David, thank you, David. I'm gonna look at this when we finish. Actually, David Eisen in Beit Shemesh, who's up very, very late, or up very early, I guess we could say, from Beit Shemesh. Again, I'm honored. Can you please also just send me an email with that? I've never seen a picture of her online, so I'll see it. But again, I have the picture of both Rav Cook's wife and the Nitziv's wife, and please see if you can find the Nitziv's wife online. Baruch says perhaps his intelligence was not apparent to the casual observer, leading some to think him a simpleton. I don't know if they called him a simpleton, just not a great London. Remember that in those days, the only people to go to yeshivas were thought to be the best and the brightest, the elites. At least that's the way it was supposed to be. It's not like today. Moshe from Lakewood. I think the story goes that people didn't recognize his genius until they found his correspondence with David Luria. That's not the story that I'm referring to. The story I'm referring to is that I don't know. I have to check on that again. I think the story I'm mentioning here, especially Eisenstadt, I'll look at it again, is actually that he wasn't. In fact, that is, it's either the Epstein version or the Eisenstadt version. It's not that he was a genius and they didn't know he was a genius until they saw his letter. It's that he wasn't a genius. He didn't come with the great intelligence, but he became great precisely because he worked at it. That's different. Yeah, the picture, David, the picture you're seeing would not be the first. It would not be the first wife. It would be the second wife. So it would not be the Aderis' daughter. No, the Aderis' daughter is the first wife. David. The Darius's daughter is the first wife, that she dies young. It's a second wife, is not the daughter of the Adaris. Therefore, it's Tzvi Yehuda Cook's grandfather is not the Adaris, Eliyahu Rabinowitz Teomi. The picture is dated 1930. Of course it can be right. Why can't it be right 1930? Thank you for that. I see David points out, very good, about the Aderis. The Aderis, for those who don't know, Elio David Rabinowitz Teomim, he was a twin. One of the great figures we'll have to get to. Thank you all. Let me just see, finally. Rav Reuven Benges was a student in the Netziv. Yes, he was a student of the Nitziv, And Reuven Bengis, thank you, Bill Gewirtz, was also very, very close to Rav Kook, so much so that although he later had certain radical, ideas, I guess right-wing, Eda Haredi type ideas, he refused to assume a position in the Eda Haredi in Jerusalem as long as Rav Kook was alive. And I mean, the Reuven Bengis tells the, is the one who repeats the story about he kept seeing Rav Kook looking in his drawer. He didn't know what that was, or under his shtender, and he looks at it. I think it was Shivitzi Asoma Negi Tami. So Reb Bengis was in awe of Rav Kook, and if you look in the letters to Rav Kook, you see letters from Reuven Bengis there. After Rav Kook passes away, Reuven Bengis then joins the Eda Haredi. How Reuven Bengis, coming from a Litvish background, would have, he's not the only one, Rav Yoel Klatskin as well, but it always is unusual when Litvish Gedolim, who come out of comes out of Volozhin, how he would have come to that type of approach, I'm not sure, but that is correct. Yes, thank you, Yossi. Actually, you're correct. He's talking. It's not that he, although he deals with everything in there, but it's his focus is mostly on the writings on the Midrashim, the Halachic Midrashim. But there's a good deal here about everything. Yeah, absolutely correct. Not just on the mostly on the Midrashim. Okay, finally, I'll just end with Moshe says that Yoel Katzen's father was Hasidish and a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, but it doesn't change the fact that he becomes a Lithuanian Torah sage, I think. I think you have to categorize him as a Lithuanian Torah sage. In any event, I thank you all. And I hope to see you all next week.